It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Nearly 1,000 Family Dollar stores are going to close around the country, including at least one here in Wisconsin. The Family Dollar in Fenimore is closing this weekend. There may be others on the list. Dollar Tree, which now owns Family Dollar, said the stores are closing because of underperformance. The Family Dollar chain was fined over $40 million last month because of rodent infestations at a warehouse facility that handled food and other FDA-regulated products. Last year, the parent company agreed to a settlement to improve worker safety after a long series of OSHA violations. Research has found that dollar stores typically operate in low-income areas with a lack of access to grocery stores. For millions of people around the country who live in food deserts, dollar stores are one of the few places, along with gas stations and convenience stores, where you can buy food. We're learning about the role dollar stores play in American communities and possible solutions for communities facing food deserts. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you shop at a Family Dollar or Dollar Tree or different dollar store? Is it the most convenient place for you to buy food where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison Karpin is co-director of the Center for Research and Education and Social Policy and professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It's an important topic.
Can you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of dollar-type stores when it comes to communities that don't have a lot of access, especially to full-service groceries?
Sure. So as you've already alluded, I think that dollar stores have filled an important gap. In the grocery market, we saw a really big boom in the dollar store market, and that was for a good reason. You know, a lot of rural communities and urban communities alike didn't have a local place to shop for some of those staple food items. And because they were so affordable, the dollar store really filled that niche. They really knew how to tailor what they were trying to do for people who were on a tight budget. I think the flip side is that not all of those items are particularly healthy. A lot of folks have wanted dollar stores for a while to offer more of a range of food, including produce and more, you know, say frozen fruits and vegetables. But that had been kind of slow to come. So I do think it's a mixed bag.
Which comes first? Do grocery stores close and then dollar stores move into communities? Or are dollar stores part of the reason that grocery stores close? Or do we have research that sorts that out?
Well, we definitely do have research that shows that when the dollar store boom happened, along with Walmart and other, you know, bigger retailers that really drew a lot of folks, we did see smaller mom and pop stores closing. We also did see a trend of smaller mom and pop stores closing. When you're a big company, you can buy a lot more product at a lower cost and then sell it at a lower cost. And it's harder for those smaller family grocery stores to compete. So I don't know that dollar stores necessarily caused the problem, but I also don't know that they were, not part of it also.
Now, food deserts already a problem. As you've mentioned, a dollar store maybe not a perfect solution, but now here we have this announcement that over the next year or so, about 1,000 communities are going to lose some version of a dollar store in just this one or a couple of chains owned by the same parent company. How worried are you about, you know, even that a loss of access to even a limited source of food?
I think it's going to be really, really hard for a lot of families. You know, driving far to get your food is expensive and time consuming. I think for a lot of the places that a dollar store is located, it really is convenient, especially in rural communities. Families with lots of kids, we have four kids, like I understand the budget, it really is tight. I do think we've seen other retailers such as Aldi come into the market, and they offer considerably competitive prices, maybe even cheaper at times than dollar stores, but they're just not located in these neighborhoods. So, you know, it's really going to be a trade-off for families to figure out how to get to do their local grocery shopping when they need to.
Talking to Allison Carpenter from the University of Delaware about dollar stores. their role in local food economies, and solutions to communities facing what are sometimes called food deserts, lack of access to full-service grocery stores to affordable and healthy food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can share your local story or your questions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Allison, do we have answers to the food desert problem? Have you seen examples of good solutions that have helped people find food where they haven't had it in the past?
Well, there's certainly no magic wand to solve this problem, but I do think we have some tools in our toolbox. We have a federal program called the Healthy Food Financing Initiative that helps to support retailers who do want to operate in lower moderate income areas and need some funds to help start up that operation. We also have seen, you know, a big boom in our farmers market community, lots of sort of alternative kinds of grocery stores that might be more specific to certain ethnic groups, halal grocery, Latin American family grocery stores. So I think we do have, you know, a breadth of options out there, but what's going to fill this gap in the short term, I think, is really what's on people's minds. And I don't know that we have a short-term solution. A lot of times these stores just kind of end up empty for a while. You know, people sort of drive by shaking their head, wondering what happened.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Ruth is with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yeah, such an important topic. Thank you for addressing this. I do want to say, though, in Wisconsin, I don't know what it's like in other states, but in Wisconsin, dollar stores were given a lot of money to establish themselves, especially during, and I don't know the full history, but I know during Scott Walker's effort to get people to work, to give them job experience.
Gotcha. Ruth, thanks for the call. Not a great connection there. Ruth saying that here in Wisconsin, and I don't know the numbers on this, that dollar stores had benefited from state government support. Is that something you've seen around the country where state tax dollars or even federal dollars end up supporting the creation of dollar stores, Allison?
I'm not sure of the nuance there in Wisconsin. I have not seen that, you know, widely discussed. I can say that dollar stores do accept SNAP funds, which has been a help for families, but have not traditionally accepted WIC. And that's because they don't really have the product mix that WIC requires. That's the program for women's infants and children. And that has really been kind of a point of discussion in terms of being able to fully serve the communities.
Thanks for that call, Ruth. We're talking about food deserts and the role that dollar stores play in the food economy, with around 1,000 family dollar stores scheduled to close around the country. Allison Carpen is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you shop at various kinds of dollar stores? Do you have a family dollar that you're worried is going to close? At least one we know in Fenimore, it will be on the list. There may be more. Do you think in your community enough access to grocery stores, to affordable, healthy food? If not, what do you want to see done about it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation about dollar stores and food deserts with the announcement that around 1,000 family dollar stores will close around the country. Allison Carpen is with us, professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your community rely on one or another of these dollar stores for food, for access to food without driving miles and miles to get it? Do you worry about what happens if they close? Do you have other better solutions you'd like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I'd like to talk about food deserts. First of all, HUD could have apartments. They have apartments. They could have community gardens there. Okay. Also, Victory Gardens for homes. Also, most cities now go into hydroponic gardens. They're growing their own greens and tomatoes, and they're selling them in the stores locally.
Mary Kay, thanks a lot for the call. Allison, the idea of locally, very locally produced food in the form of community gardens, city greenhouses, things like that. Can that be part of the food desert solution puzzle?
Absolutely. I love the suggestion. And I think there's really great examples across the country. She mentioned hydroponics. There's lots of efforts. It's a great way to get communities involved, make some money, sell to businesses. We haven't really seen it be something that, supports a whole city, let's say, but it definitely is part of an important solution to understand where your food comes from, growing it, selling it locally. Definitely a great idea.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mary Kay, at 800-642-1234. Allison, people might think the market would solve this problem. If there's a whole bunch of communities without access to groceries and produce, some enterprising entrepreneur would move in and open up a store there, but the economics don't seem to work out that way. Do we know why?
Well, I think this is a bit of an interesting time to see really what does happen next. You know, when we did see sort of Walmart's move in, smaller mom and pop stores closing, then we did see the influx of dollar stores come into the market. Now the dollar stores are phasing out. What will fill them? It's not entirely, impossible that we won't see a resurgence of some smaller, more specialty stores fill that gap. But it's also possible that folks will just expect that we're going to do more online ordering, more deliveries to the extent possible, and, more large stock up buying as part of the trend. I think we're going to have to wait and see.
Here in Wisconsin, we've got at least one gas station convenience store chain that's known for having added produce, not huge produce sections, but some produce section to the mix. Is that one area where you're watching to see if, places where we can buy, we think of them as junk food places where maybe there's better quality food available?
I hadn't really thought of it because, dollar stores and produce don't typically go hand in hand, but I do think that, we know the typical shopper does, a lot of quick stop-in shops, maybe once or twice a week for that one item that you need for a recipe or something, or you just ran out of. And so, yeah, I think you want to just run around the corner. You don't want to drive 15 or 20 minutes or 20 miles to go, pick up an onion. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of those alternatives do start to come into play for people.
What are your concerns for people's health and well-being if they don't have access to things like produce and other healthy food?
Well, I think that we know, right, that eating healthy food is critical for everything from our children's development to, cancers and other disease prevention, also just our mental health, all of it. It's all connected. But so is, poverty. And we haven't talked much about jobs, but mm-hmm. Some of these stores also, provided jobs and an economic driver in communities, which will also be lost. Not to mention, the idea that now we'll just have an empty sort of, almost depressing looking building that people are, often in communities that have been forgotten anyway, are now going to also have to walk by, which doesn't necessarily add to feeling like you're living in a strong, empowered community either. So I think that there's a number of potential impacts that go, beyond health here too.
I've seen some arguments that communities at the local level or maybe state governments should do more to subsidize an old-fashioned full-service grocery store in communities that we might call food deserts. Do you think that's a possible policy solution?
I do. We have seen pretty good success with, I mentioned earlier, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative, which was an initiative that began in Pennsylvania. It has now become a federal initiative. In many states, it can become a public-private effort where there's funding to subsidize the upstart effectively, but not necessarily the ongoing operation, just to try and get stores over that initial hurdle. Because as you can imagine, opening a supermarket in a neighborhood is not cheap. So people need sometimes a little boost to get that inventory and the infrastructure set up there for that. So I do think that this might be a good time for Wisconsin to think about a financing initiative or accessing those federal funds to be able to help rebuild some of these stores.
Now, at least some dollar stores, reading up on this, do have a limited produce section. Do we know about the quality? If when dollar stores, the percentage that has produce have them, is it good stuff? Is it quality stuff?
So we do know that there are, like you said, some limited stores that do it. All reports show that that is reasonably, you know, good quality product. People haven't complained about it. They've been sort of pilot stores for the dollar store brand. And so, yeah, I think they're fine. That's what we've heard.
Let's bring on another caller. Craig is with us in Gays Mills. Craig, hi.
Hey, I was just wondering, are throwing out the fact that a lot of these stores like Dollar General and Family Dollar, they're all in really close proximity to each other, and that could be a unwritten thing that they're not bringing to light here. I know, like in the Wisconsin store in Fenimore, the Family Dollar is only two blocks from a new Dollar General, so that could be a reason that some of these stores are closing in a lot of these locations.
Got it. Craig, interesting point. There could be oversaturation in some markets of dollar stores, and that'll lead at least some of them, Allison, to close. What do you think?
Absolutely. We've seen this happen in the grocery market too. You know, it used to be sort of a common joke that when you went to one grocery store, there was another one behind you and another one behind you on the other corner. And yet you had to drive, you know, 20 miles to get to that particular intersection. Yeah, I think competition is definitely at play here. News reports have also talked a lot about changes in price and quality of stores. Maintaining stores is not easy. We've had trouble with getting the employees across the board for a lot of industries that stores need to operate well. And I think once there's a gap and there's another alternative right down the street, why not go somewhere else?
Craig, thanks for that call. And Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Allison Karpin, co-director of the Center for Research in Education and Social Policy and professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Delaware. She talked to us about the closure of dollar stores around the country, including here in Wisconsin, and wider concerns about food deserts in urban and rural communities around the country. Many Milwaukee residents say reckless driving is a crisis. In response to rising deaths from traffic crashes, the city is spending tens of millions of dollars to remake its streets. As Evan Casey reports, new street designs are a key part of plans to make the city safer for everybody.
On a warm summer day in 2021, Julie Wellinger's son went out to grab snacks at the gas station with his friends. She had just laid down for a nap when a neighbor knocked on her door.
She said there's been a terrible accident. They don't think there's any survivors.
Wellinger's 22-year-old son, Gerald, and his friend both died after the car they were in was hit by two drivers racing down the street. It's been almost 3 years since the crash.
When I hear sirens going by, my heart starts to beat really heavy because I'm thinking, what if it's someone else getting in an accident?
Unfortunately, Wellinger's story isn't unique. Since the pandemic, Milwaukee has averaged more than 70 traffic deaths per year. Risky driving behavior has increased nationally in that time, too. But in Milwaukee, experts say wide lanes of traffic and high speed limits aren't helping the issue. This year, the city will spend around $86 million on street safety improvements to help lower speeds. That's as much as it's spent on the issue in the last 4 years combined. On the corner of Burleigh and Fond du Lac, the risky driving behavior is easy to spot. Drivers are running red lights and swerving in and out of parking lanes to get around traffic. Many pedestrians and drivers have learned to live with it. Community activist Von Mays says it can be annoying to deal with.
The light says green. You have to give it a 5 or maybe 8 second pause before it's really green and then go through, because somebody is apt to just blow through that red light.
Officials say there are three main ways they're trying to tackle the issue: education, enforcement, and engineering. Education is what it sounds like. Things like social media public safety campaigns and expanding driver's ed courses in school. Enforcement includes officers handing out reckless driving citations and towing vehicles of repeat reckless driving offenders. But the city has been especially aggressive on engineering. Across Milwaukee, street redesign projects have added features like raised crosswalks, speed humps, curb bumpouts, and protected bike lanes. Some are temporary fixes, like planters and plastic posts. Others are permanent, like concrete curb extensions which narrow the roadway. In 2020, only 46 bumpouts were installed across the city. Last year, that number rose to more than 900. City engineer Kevin Muse says the goal is to reduce speeds.
The faster people go, if they hit something, it's more dangerous. And the faster people go, the more likely they are to hit something.
By the end of this year, Milwaukee will have spent around $170 million on street safety projects since 2020. Muse knows some residents have complained that the changes make it harder to get around the city.
It's not always convenient. It's definitely not convenient what we're doing, right? But it is necessary, I think, if we're going to try to create a safer city for everybody.
At an open house on the city's south side, residents have gathered to share their thoughts on what they want to see done. Every idea is on the table. Some people are in favor of more speed humps. Others want to see a change in state law to allow the city to install red light cameras. But everyone says more needs to be done. Patricia Luevano often rides her bicycle on the city's south side. She says she has to keep a watchful eye out for bad drivers.
And they don't even respect, and you are just so afraid that somebody can hit you.
Milwaukee has recently adopted a Vision Zero plan in an attempt to achieve zero traffic deaths by 2037. Jessica Weinberg is that program's policy director. She thinks that goal is lofty, but attainable.
But it does take all of us deciding we're going to go a little slower, we're going to change how we design our streets, and we're going to think about roads as a place where we show our concern for our community rather than just try to get somewhere as quick as we can.
This month, the city set up a new public dashboard for people to view the progress for themselves. It shows 4 fatal crashes so far this year across Milwaukee County. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Read more about that story and lots more from the Wisconsin Public Radio news team. You can head on over to WPR.org to read and share stories. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for news stories, live streaming, archives, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, Wisconsin's Supreme Court ruled that the charitable arm of the Catholic Diocese in Superior does not get a religious exemption from paying into the state's unemployment insurance system. Legal representatives for the Catholic Charities Bureau say they're going to try to appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. An expert on religion and the law is here to break down the arguments in the case and what it says about how we interpret religious liberties in the United States. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that religious service organizations like the Catholic Charities Bureau should get special exemptions that other secular charitable organizations don't? Have you worked for a religious service organization? Do you think the work they do qualifies for religious exemptions under the law? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Adam Kuntz is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. It's good to be back.
Well, this case, Adam, touches on a lot of big issues. Let's keep it narrow for a moment. Can you talk us through the details of this case and what was at stake?
Sure, absolutely. So basically, we've got two parties here. We've got on the one side the state, which is represented in this case by a couple of agencies that are basically charged with managing the state's unemployment insurance scheme. It's a state unemployment insurance scheme that basically every other state has. We all pay into it as employees. Our employers pay into it so that if there's an unemployment situation that comes up, we can collect unemployment benefits and until we find another job. On the other side is the Catholic Charities Bureau, which is specifically an entity within the Diocese of Superior. So it's a sub-organization within the broader diocese in the northern part of Wisconsin. And this particular charity had four different groups that it decided to affiliate with. These groups were not religious in nature at all. One example was the Barron County Development Services Incorporated, which basically coaches people for job placement, works with people with disabilities. Before 2014, they had absolutely nothing to do with the diocese. They were not religious at all, had no religious affiliation, and they received no funding from the church. The other three entities that we're talking about here were a little bit like that. So mostly secular organizations that decided for financial reasons to associate with the Catholic Church. Around 2015, a circuit court decision was rendered in Douglas County that basically called into question whether or not an entity like this, so one of these nested entities, would have to pay into the unemployment insurance scheme. And since 2015, the Catholic Charities has been fighting with the agencies at the Wisconsin state level to get exemptions for all four of these entities so that they would not have to pay into the state unemployment insurance scheme. It has gone back and forth a couple different directions. Two agencies have looked at it. There's an administrative law judge that's looked at it. A trial court judge has looked at it. And then it's gone all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And ultimately, what the court held was that these four entities aren't exempt under a statute that gives exemptions for religious organizations. So that's the plain and simple of it.
That's great. And Adam, I want to pick up on that last point. There is this exemption in unemployment insurance, and I think various tax laws as well, for religious institutions. And that's been interpreted generally, correct me if I'm wrong, to mean it's the house of worship or it's a monastery or something like that, something with the sole intention of doing the religion. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, you have that exactly right. Basically, what the statute specifically says is that it will give an exemption to, quote, an organization operated primarily for religious purposes and then controlled, quote, by a church. So those two factors in the statute are what entitle an organization to an exemption. Primarily religious is kind of the key phrase here.
And as I understand it, the challengers here representing the Catholic Charities said, well, hang on, we're doing this stuff. We've affiliated with these charities because we're Catholic. We're performing our religious mission via these organizations. How do you read this? The state Supreme Court obviously didn't agree with that. How do you read that?
So the way that I read this is the court is looking to try to understand what the intent of the legislature is. They did a really great job, I think, of doing what's called a textualist or originalist analysis, where they dug into what the Wisconsin legislature must have meant by religious exemptions here or religious purpose, and using a series of case law to basically to determine whether or not there's a religious motivation and what kind of activities an organization would be doing. Those two factors are relevant to that analysis. And what the court did is they said, you know, it may be the case that you have declared yourself as part of the Catholic umbrella, but you are about four steps down from the actual Catholic Church, and your activities that you're engaged in are not what we would consider to be religious in nature. That really was what broke the case for the majority on the court. It was the fact that essentially the kinds of things that these organizations were doing, while perhaps being motivated in the same way that a Catholic person might be motivated to give charitably, those purposes were ultimately being done through a secular vehicle. So the kinds of things we'd normally see from an unemployment agency that we could just see, you know, in a strip mall driving down the road, that's the kinds of things that were being done by these organizations. And I think that's what tipped the balance for the court.
Now, this is a tight majority, 4-3, the usual liberal conservative split on the court. I want to talk about the stakes a little bit, Adam. I imagine these charities might not be huge employers, but could, if the court had ruled the other way in favor of the charities, How about a hospital that has a religious affiliation, or a university or college that has a religious affiliation? There we're starting to talk about a bigger employers. Could, if this decision had gone the other way, could it have applied to organizations like that?
I think so. I think so. Let's take Marquette University, one of our banner universities here in Wisconsin, and one that's affiliated with the Catholic Church. It has a mission that's tied back to Catholicism. It is an entity that is mostly private, receives most of its funding through tuition. It has a predominantly secular purpose, which is to educate students. It has a law school, which produces lawyers. And essentially, if the court had gone the other direction here, as long as you're nested underneath the umbrella of a religion, and you can cite some religion as being the thing that's ultimately the tree from which you're falling here, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. The dissenting opinions in this case would essentially have us go that way, that as long as you're tied back in some way and make a plausible case that, well, our doctrine requires things like education, well, then ergo Marquette University is also engaged in religious conduct, ergo they're entitled to an exemption, and therefore Marquette does not have to pay into any of the unemployment insurance. All the staff, faculty, from janitors all the way up to administrators, would now no longer be within the state's unemployment insurance scheme.
Adam Kuntz is with us, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, looking at church and state exemptions for religious organizations, in this case from workplace compensation laws. A state Supreme Court ruling says that can't be expanded to charitable groups that operate under the umbrella of churches. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Adam, let's look at some wider issues here. We have these religious exemptions in workers' compensation rules for a house of worship, say, other tax-related laws. Why? Why are religious groups exempted in the first place?
Well, I think there's probably two answers to that. One is that there's a kind of cultural reason why we do this. The United States is a religious country. There's a long history of religious worship in the United States. It's baked into our culture. We are also a pluralist culture when it comes to our religious beliefs. So we at least ostensibly say that everyone's welcome when it comes to religious belief. And so I think legislatures like those in Wisconsin want to carve out these exceptions for religions to, in essence, keep as much of a wall between the state and religion as possible. Let religions do the good work that they want to do without state involvement. The other layer to this, though, is that we have the First Amendment, and the First Amendment explicitly says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Those two clauses, the free exercise and the establishment clause, are in somewhat conflict with one another. On the one hand, the state needs to treat religion carefully and let you practice your faith in whatever way you wish, freely exercise it. On the other hand, the state can't also prop up a religion and establish a religion. And so one of the tensions that always comes up in cases like this is when the state decides to give an exemption for religious belief, it necessarily then has to ask the question, well, is this religious? Which then raises some radar problems with the Establishment Clause. Is the state now wading in and digging into the question of what counts as religion? The dissent and Beckett Law Firm, which is the one that was representing the Catholic Charities in this case, would very much like the state to always defer in religious cases, to assume that everything is religious and to always treat it as lightly as possible for that Establishment Clause reason. On the other hand, there's substantial arguments from the founders all the way back to the pre-colonial period that states have to, in order to decide whether or not to give exemptions, states have to first ask, is this religious? And I think what Wisconsin did at their Supreme Court level was walk that line very, very narrowly and very carefully.
We're talking to Adam Kuntz, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, about a Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling against extending religious exemptions for the Catholic Charities Bureau when it comes to workers' comp payments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on that particular ruling and the narrow issue? Or do you have thoughts or questions about how we treat religious organizations under the law, under tax codes, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Adam Kuntz, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the Wisconsin Supreme Court's recent ruling that the charitable arm of the Catholic Diocese in Superior does not get a religious exemption from paying into the state's unemployment insurance system. I said workers' comp earlier. Unemployment insurance was this particular case. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with that decision? Do you have questions about it? Do you want to see it go to the U.S. Supreme Court? Call in with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I have an opinion on this real quick. I just want to say that when the Diocese of Superior subcontracts for work, like with a concrete masonry organization or a landscaping service, they don't object to the bid, which does pay into the unemployment insurance. So I would have liked to have seen the diocese take the moral high road and not fight this. Also, I guess I'm unsure as to whether the people providing this service in the four nested organizations, I don't think they're employees of the diocese. Are they?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Adam.
Yeah. So, Jeff, as to your first point, I fully agree. I think that if we take this line of thinking that the charities tried to make before the court, I think what we do is we start opening up the door, which is, I think, the intention behind what Beckett Law Group is doing, is to open up the door to look at other things that churches are doing, like government contracts. And so I think your point's absolutely valid. That does every single time that a church does anything, is it subject to this kind of inquiry? So I think that's a fair point. As to the second one, when we're talking about these four particular entities, they are not employees of the diocese. We're talking about subcontractors within subcontractors. It's notable, by the way, and I want to emphasize this, that nothing was really lost here for the Catholic charities. This is not a sea change for them. These particular charitable organizations had existed before 2015, had been paying into the insurance scheme. They were doing so afterwards. Catholic Charities has paid into that insurance scheme for decades. It's only been since 2015 that they've been attempting to fight this, and that's simply because there's been this attempt to activize or to look for these kinds of loopholes in the statutory language.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have a question. Does this apply, or could it apply to, like, Lutheran social services or Jewish social services?
Kay, thanks a lot for the call. And I know various religious groups, Adam, had an interest in this and may have filed relevant briefs in this.
They did. So this is kind of an interesting feature of all religious cases, is you'll oftentimes get amicus briefs from other religious entities, too, because at the end of the day, organized religions are like any organization, like any company, any group would be looking for a tax advantage or a financial advantage. There's nothing bad about that. Organizations want to protect their bottom line, and Catholic charities and Lutheran charitable services are no exemption to that. So if you can find an opportunity not to have to pay taxes, of course, you'll look for that opportunity. So cases like this, if Lutheran services does reach out to an entity that has existed separately from it for some time, and that entity has decided, hey, we want to affiliate, potentially this ruling would be just as applicable to that organization as any other, regardless of what kind of religion you would be. What's interesting is that when we get into these conversations, the Beckett Law Group that's behind this has also fought, on the other hand, the sincerity of belief of other organizations. They opposed the Reformed Jewish argument that abortion should be protected for Reformed Jews under religious belief grounds. And Beckett Law Group opposed that, claiming that this was not sincere belief. So what we end up getting into with things like this is now it becomes an interreligious fight as to whose beliefs really count as sincere and who gets to really get protections.
Thanks, Kay, for the call. Brad joins us now in Madison. Brad, hello.
Hi. I support the Supreme Court, Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision. And I think it makes just common sense. My comment is that if it is accepted on appeal at the U.S. Supreme Court, I sort of feel like, you know, they've shown themselves in the past few years to be very open to expanding the role of religion in government, in society. And so I sort of feel like I won't say the deck is stacked exactly, but the time might be right for the church to bring this to the U.S. Supreme Court and to have, again, a change made in how many of us sort of see the separation of church and state.
Brad, thanks for the call. Adam, take us to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I mean, Brad, you brought up the elephant in the room. So the church does plan to appeal this to SCOTUS. Now, keep in mind, SCOTUS gets about 8,000 petitions for certiorari a year, so your chances of getting accepted are pretty slim. They only accept about 60 cases a year. So is this going to be one that's going to get there? As I tell my constitutional law students, the best way to get in front of the court is to have a circuit split or a state law split. So if other states have rendered a different decision from Wisconsin, then we've got a conflict somewhere, and SCOTUS would be in the position to resolve that. On the other hand, you know, I do share Brad's kind of concern in the sense that, you know, Justice Alito is close affiliates with the folks that founded Beckett Law Group that are the ones that are leading the charge here. So there is that connection. Justice Alito is also an ardent Catholic who has given speeches at the Vatican before. There is a Catholic majority, supermajority of conservatives on the court. And as Brad points out, the court has shown in the last 5 years, which is not accidental given the way that this particular case has percolated, the court has shown its willingness to stretch the meaning of statutory language to cover as many sins as a religion would like to have it covered. And so I think there is a pretty good chance that it might end up before the court, maybe not this time, but a case like this, if another state rules a different direction, or if a federal court has a different interpretation and that sets up that conflict of law, then yeah, I think the Supreme Court could be in a position to take this up. Now, whether or not they will go that far, it's a little bit hard to say. What we have seen is that there is some disagreement amongst even the conservatives on the court as to what to do in cases like this. So if you do this, what doors are you opening up down the road? And Justice Comey Barrett is an example of one who's been a little bit reluctant to say, well, what do we do instead? If we do open this door, what's the next case going to look like? So maybe cooler heads might prevail. Who knows?
Thanks for that call, Brad. Adam, I want to ask something. Maybe it's far-fetched. Let me know if it is. Say a private company looked at a ruling like this, if it had gone the other way or if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns it, say Hobby Lobby, which I believe has been represented by the same law firm, and says, well, we're in business for a religious cause. We use money for religious purposes. We have a religious-based mission. Could they take advantage of this and say, well, we should be exempt too?
Well, I think that's when we start to make connections with Hobby Lobby, that is kind of the worst case scenario. And, you know, Rob, I don't want to speculate too much as to what could come from that, but your intuitions are absolutely right. If religious purpose under this Wisconsin statute is writ broadly here, and if we're willing to say, well, they're not under the supervision of a church under this particular statute, could a private organization do that? There's at least an argument there, and it's one that could certainly percolate its way up the chain. I would hope that cooler heads would prevail at that point, because at that stage, any private company could potentially say, well, we're just doing this in the name of religion, provided that a board of directors or a CEO or someone in control has some religious beliefs at stake.
And then looking to the future, we've already talked a little bit about whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court would take this up. Do you expect to see similar cases coming up in other states, in part maybe with the intent of getting it to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I absolutely do. So this is when I used to work at a law firm, this is an effort that I think law firms do try to accomplish. So Beckett Law Group has as their mission, it's in their mission statement, to try to protect rights that come from God. And they seek out cases like this. So even if they don't necessarily get this case before the court now, they are absolutely going to be looking for another one in another state somewhere else. They may even be doing that currently. So the fact that they produce law clerks that serve on the Supreme Court, the fact that they weigh in on Supreme Court justices, Beckett Law Group, this is their mission. And so we will at some point see another case like this.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be back.
That's Adam Kuntz, assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He helped us break down a recent decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which says that the Catholic Charities Bureau in Superior does not get a religious exemption from paying into the state's unemployment insurance system, and how it fits into wider issues and could end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, what is the most physically demanding job in the U.S. workforce? I know it's not radio host. Find out what jobs do make the list and how you could try to measure that sort of thing in the first place. You can weigh in with your nomination starting right now. What is the most physically demanding job out there or that you've done? Email ideas at WPR.org. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. It was photo day for me and some other people here at Wisconsin Public Radio when they take pictures to use on the website and publicity and stuff like that. Here's the thing. Think about the skills and attributes that might make someone go into a career talking on the radio. Make a quick mental list. Is photogenic on your list? Probably not. And there's the problem. I'm pretty bad at having my picture taken. This is not some kind of false modesty. Like, there are some things in life I'm good at. There's some things in life I'm bad at. Like, in any given room full of people, I'm probably the worst dancer there. Same goes for having my picture taken. Now, everybody involved in the process was super nice. Nobody said I was the worst at WPR at posing for pictures, even when I asked straight up if I was the worst. If you end up seeing one of these pictures of me and you think, Rob, that's not so bad. One, thank you. And B, remember, it's like the best out of 1,000 or so. A word is worth 1,000 pictures. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book about John F. Kennedy's historic primary run in Wisconsin in 1960 and how it helped launch him to the presidency. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about a Wisconsin community's iconic creatures.
Trolls are everywhere you look in the Dane County village of Mount Horeb. Troll cartoons on the street signs, troll footprints on the sidewalk, sculptures of trolls lining Main Street. The sheer number of trolls in the community prompted a Wisconsin listener to ask, what's the deal with all the trolls? WPR's Tim Peterson went to find the answer.
Over the years, Leah Jaber has frequented a Mount Horeb tea shop with her family. During each visit, the trolls always got the attention of the Madison East High School senior. You know, trolls, those ugly and dim-witted, yet powerful ancient figures from Norway's pagan past. To satisfy her curiosity, Jaber reached out to WPR's Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that got me curious is basically just seeing all the trolls but having no idea where they came from or what they represent or what they mean.
I invited Jaber to join me to find the answer in Mount Horeb, officially trademarked the troll capital of the world. We meet at the Mount Horeb Area Historical Society, where Destiny Udelhoven is the director. She says they get asked about the trolls constantly.
What's the deal with the trolls? That's like exactly how they ask it.
Udelhoven says the abundance of trolls harkens back to the area's Norwegian heritage and a marketing push to attract visitors.
I think that's what I want people to see as a historian, is that the trolls didn't spring out of nowhere. We didn't pick them because they were just the most marketable thing. You know, they really have a strong, deep connection to our history here.
That connection being two major waves of Norwegian immigrants to the Mount Horeb area in the mid and late 19th century. Mount Horeb is known for its lasting Norwegian culture, a living museum outside of town with Norwegian-style buildings, annual Norwegian musical performances, and a water tower covered in rosemaling, a stylized Norwegian floral painting. In the 80s, a Mount Horeb resident was also crafting two-dimensional birch bark trolls. Jaber saw these up close at the Historical Society.
So you can walk down this little crevice and you can see, you can be surrounded by the trollness of them. Go ahead, you're the one who asked. Yes. Go down there, experience it.
They're definitely different than the carved trolls because they're painted kind of realistically. So yeah, I guess I'm I'm a tiny bit scared, but I think it's kind of like joyous energy, I guess.
The carved trolls, the ones you may have seen lining Main Street, the chicken thief, the mayor, local artist Mike Feeney did most of them.
I kind of get a kick out of them because they're humorous. They're a little bit off-center. Trolls really are not like the kind of cuddly things that you want to bring home. The Norwegian trolls are mean and nasty. They'll poison your well, they'll burn your crops. But the Mount Horeb ones are more like the New World trolls, a little happier, a little more jovial, and a little bit off-kilter.
Feeney was commissioned by the village in the 1980s to solve a marketing problem. That's according to Jim Leary, professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also a longtime resident of Mount Horeb.
In the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18-151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit.
Not everyone in the village loved the trolls right away, and Feeney says some came around when they started getting results.
They kind of fought for their existence, the trolls did, and then the people behind them really enjoyed them, and then apparently they brought a lot of people coming to town, taking their picture in front of the troll.
And while the trolls aren't for everyone, many locals will tell you they're lucky. And in this village, trolls are the protectors of the residents, the businesses, and nature.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on Mount Horeb's trolls. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of WPR's Wisconsin. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. On January 2nd, 1960, then U.S. Senator John F. Kennedy formally announced that he would seek the Democratic presidential nomination.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I believe that any Democratic aspirant to this important nomination should be willing to submit to the voters his views, record, and competence in a series of primary contests. I am therefore now announcing my intention of filing in the New Hampshire primary, and I shall announce my plans with respect to other primaries as their filing dates approach.
Kennedy would go on to campaign in multiple key primary races, including here in Wisconsin. And campaigning was different then. Picture the candidate shaking hands with 1,500 meatpacking plant workers in 15 below weather. One of the candidate's brothers hiking 5 miles along a train track after snow stopped the train to Eau Claire. The other brother making a first ever ski jump in Middleton. Our next guest is the author of a new book that tells the story of John F. Kennedy's historic victory here in the state and some of the Wisconsinites involved in it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you in Wisconsin during John F. Kennedy's primary campaign in 1960? Or do you have family or local stories about that point in history? Do you wish more presidential candidates would go to lots and lots of towns these days? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. BJ Hollers is a professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. His new book is called Wisconsin for Kennedy, the primary that launched a president and changed the course of history. BJ will talk about his new book at a few events coming up around the state, including tonight at Mystery to Me Bookstore in Madison, April 2nd at the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire, and April 25th at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. BJ, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, thanks so much for having me.
All right, we need to set the scene a little bit here. Primaries was different in those days. Not every state did them. Most states didn't. Why was the Wisconsin primary so important on the path in 1960?
That's a great question. Well, the Wisconsin primary was the first contested primary race during that initial 1960 season. And so Kennedy knew he really did not have the advantage of trying to get the nomination at the convention. He did not have the big bosses behind him. He had to prove himself in the Midwest. And so the primary strategy was a way to accomplish all of those things. But it was an uphill battle indeed.
and you ran across a treasure trove of oral histories from people involved in this campaign, including a lot of people here in Wisconsin. Could you talk about this source that provided so much of the material for your book?
Absolutely. Well, it kind of happened during the COVID year, spring 2020. I was not doing a lot of traveling. None of us were. So I started looking online at archival resources online. I came across the JFK Presidential Museum and Libraries database, and there was a folder that said Wisconsin. I was very curious about that. I double clicked and I found these incredible interviews, as you said, with well-known people, but also with lesser known people, all of whom played a role in Wisconsin's 1960 primary. And you put them together and you start to assemble this team of often little known Wisconsinites who helped JFK find a way to beat Hubert Humphrey and go all the way to the nomination and finally the presidency.
And if people are expecting a really dry political science history here, that is not how you tell the story. Can you talk about the style and the tension and how you tried to tell this story?
Well, you know, when I was writing this, I came across this Rudyard Kipling quote, and he said, "If history were told in the form of stories, it would never be forgotten." And I just love that quote. I was watching a lot of the TV show The West Wing at the time. I was reading a lot of Theodore H. White's political history, and I really wanted this to be a cinematic story. It is a vivid account in its own right, so I wanted to bring these characters to life as best I could.
All right, setting the scene again now. People within John F. Kennedy's inner circle, including his brother Bobby, said, yeah, let's not do Wisconsin. A lot of people on there were like, Wisconsin's dangerous. It could ruin this whole thing for us. Why is that?
It was a very tough decision. Joe Kennedy Sr., Kennedy's dad, said that Wisconsin was the crisis of the campaign. And Kennedy himself said that if I am beaten in Wisconsin, I am out. So the stakes were huge in the Badger State. Had he lost here, he would pretty much be reaffirming to the big political bosses that he was not electable in the Midwest, that a Catholic could not win in a state with a lot of Protestants, and those were going to be problems. So he had a lot of an uphill battle, as I said, to make it happen. But Wisconsin was the best way to prove himself, and he did it here.
And we think about campaigning these days, I think, BJ, okay, the president, the candidate is having a rally, or they go to a factory with a really prearranged photo op. What was this campaign like in Wisconsin?
Oh my gosh. It in some ways feels so helter-skelter. I mean, I found this picture where Kennedy's standing next to a guy, and I was wondering, who is this guy? Turned out his name was Pete DeGaulle. He lived in Cadott, Wisconsin. He met Kennedy after a campaign event and said, "You want a lift to Eau Claire?" And Kennedy said, okay. And he hopped in his car, and Pete DeGaulle became his driver for some time. There's a story of a guy named Jerry Bruno. He's an eighth grade dropout from Kenosha. He drove forklift for a long time. He ended up being the guy who helped plan all of Kennedy's travel in the White House, including parts of the Dallas trip. So it's just incredible what these Wisconsinites did together. And again, they kind of came from humble means often.
And one of the big challenges facing John F. Kennedy in this whole campaign was his perception as the Catholic candidate. He was Catholic. The one time a major party had nominated a Catholic, Al Smith, it went very poorly. Wisconsin had some Eastern and Middle Catholicism, some very strong Protestant areas. How did that all play out in that Wisconsin campaign?
Well, he gave it his best, and he kind of worked toward refining some of the harder questions about his Catholicism. He really got it right in Houston a few months later. But even in Wisconsin, he was trying to find a way to win over Protestants, which was tricky. He ultimately lost the 9th and 10th district, kind of in the Eau Claire area and some of the more Protestant areas. That was Hubert Humphrey country, to be sure. But he found a way to make inroads there. And so later he told folks, you know, if I'm going to not have an opportunity to be president based solely on my religion, and that's, you know, so many millions of people who also won't be able to do that. And that's not the America we are, which was the answer that finally won a lot of folks over to him.
BJ Hollers is with us, professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, author of several books. His latest is Wisconsin for Kennedy, the primary that launched a president and changed the course of history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this campaign, memories of it if you were there watching, or maybe is there some local legend? A lot of communities in Wisconsin all over the place name dropped in this book. There's a good chance that John F. Kennedy did visit your town. Are there stories about that? Maybe in your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Eau Claire Professor BJ Hollers about his new book, Wisconsin for Kennedy. It gives a behind-the-scenes look at John F. Kennedy's historic 1960 primary campaign here in Wisconsin. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Good. What do you want to ask about?
A couple things. So, first of all, I wondered if you could tell me if this sounds something like John F. Kennedy for people who might not be familiar with his voice, and that's, ask not what your country can do for you. Mm-hmm. Ask what you can do for your country.
Pretty good. Pretty good. A little Diamond Joe Quimby there, too. What else did you want to ask about, Jack?
Yeah, so I was just thinking, it does seem like Wisconsin has a reputation as one of the keystone states that candidates vying for president need to win on their path to the White House. And so I was just kind of thinking, what were some of JFK and his team's first impressions about our state when you decided to campaign here? And then what were some of his takeaways efforts? Like, what was he expecting? What turned out differently or similarly to what he was expecting going in here?
Oh, great question, Jack. BJ, you look at that a lot.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think Kennedy quite knew what he was getting himself into when he got here. You know, they were, again, mostly East Coast elite folks, hadn't spent a lot of time here. He didn't even come to Wisconsin until the mid to late 50s. But when he came back, after he got to know people very well during those winter months in 1960, he gave a speech and he said, I suppose that there's no training ground for the presidency, but I don't think it's a bad idea for a president to have stood outside of Meyer's Meat Factory in Madison, Wisconsin at 5:30 in the morning with the temperature 10 above. So it really became a training ground for his presidency. He didn't intend it for it to be that way, but that's how it worked out in the end.
Thanks, Jack, for the call at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Dubuque. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
I was living in Benton, Wisconsin. I was in the school band. I was in the 6th or 7th grade. And he made a stop in Dubuque, Iowa, across from the Julian Dubuque Bridge. And we were invited as a band to be there. So,
Tom, thanks for the call. I'm laughing, BJ, because this was a very deliberate Kennedy strategy. Tell us about the bands.
It absolutely is, Tom. That's a great observation. The final chapter in the book talks about how much Kennedy valued bands in order to increase the crowd size. If you said if you could a band on every corner of a parade, that means for every 50 band members, you maybe have 100 parents, you get some grandparents. If you get enough bands, you'll always get a big crowd. So Kennedy really used the bands to his advantage. So you were a part of that, Tom.
Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's great. Diane is with us now in Madison. Diane, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment and ask about the connection with the Catholic Workers Movement. I met a woman in Milwaukee who was raised by three aunts that were very Catholic, and her father, and very Catholic, and they were very involved in the Kennedy campaign. But later, I wanted to know about what there was the Catholic Workers Movement connection. I'm wondering if you just ran across anything in your research.
Interesting question, Diane. Question. I don't remember that in the book, BJ.
Yeah, there's not a lot of that in this research, I'm afraid to say. I guess I will say that it was more less about the work, but more just to speak to the larger topic. During the campaign, Kennedy was very reluctant to speak about his religion. There was a day on St. Patrick's Day, in fact, when he was driving through Wisconsin, and there were a group of nuns on the side of the road. The campaign begged him to keep driving, but they stopped, and he got a photo in Life magazine. The campaign was terrified about all the associations with the Catholic Church, but ultimately, again, he won everyone over. It's a bit of a dodge for your question, but at least it's a story that speaks a bit to the religion aspect here in Wisconsin.
Thanks for the call. We are talking to BJ Hollers from UW-Eau Claire about his new book, Wisconsin for Kennedy, the primary that launched a president and changed the course of history. BJ, you mentioned a couple names of Wisconsinites that then Senator Kennedy worked with on his campaign. A more familiar name, Vel Phillips. She was a key figure in Wisconsin and around the country with black people a little leery about Kennedy's civil rights credentials. Can you talk about how he won her over and the role she played?
It's a great story. And yes, she was very leery at the start. She didn't like the way he'd voted on a civil rights related issue as a senator. He took her aside. He learned from her. He talked with her. And ultimately, he won her over. There's a moment where they're getting their photograph taken together. And Kennedy said to Vel, oh, you know, Jackie has an outfit just like that. And Vel thought he was just, you know, pandering to her. A year later, they meet again, and Jackie says, "Oh, I heard we have the same outfit, and I thought you might not believe me. So here it is." And she pulled it out of the closet just to prove to Val Phillips that they had the same outfit. So just a very personal approach to campaigning.
Now, Val Phillips goes on to a very prominent career in Wisconsin politics, a lot of firsts for her. But she plays a role. There's an amazing scene where she's with Kennedy before he addresses, I think it's a big convention of the NAACP. Can you share that story?
Oh, that's a great moment. It's the day before the Democratic National Convention in L.A., and Kennedy is a nervous wreck about speaking before the NAACP. A Johnson representative had just done so. He'd gotten booed off stage. He was sweating, but Val really encouraged him. Go out there, be yourself, see what you can do. And in the end, he got the crowd clapping for him. He really won them over, and he very gratefully walked back to Val, who was clapping. He gave her a wink, and he thanked her for encouraging him to go there, to make himself known, to help people understand where he was coming from. And to learn about civil rights in a way he really hadn't growing up. Hubert Humphrey played a huge role, too, in helping push him towards civil rights. And so that's another interesting side story here.
Just a little bit more on the nuts and bolts of campaigning in Wisconsin. You know, some events had the bands and hundreds of people. There were some other stops. I think one in Cornell, Wisconsin, where there was a crowd of eight or so people at a diner.
There's a great scene in Theodore H. White's book where you got Kennedy roaming through Phillips in these tiny towns, and it's just like tumbleweed. There is no one who even knows there. He goes up to a guy in a bar and goes, "Hi, I'm John Kennedy. I'm running for president." And the guy goes, "President of what?" He didn't even know who he was. So some wonderful stories. He had a lot of room to make things up. One of the best stories is when Jackie Kennedy's in a supermarket in Kenosha. She took over the loudspeaker while people were shopping and shared with folks why they ought to vote for her husband. So it was really kind of guerrilla marketing every way they could get it.
Time for one more caller. Christina's with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi. Well, this campaign is a part of my family history. My dad, who's 89 now, was a student at UW-River Falls, and he and my mom were married. There were two of us kids, and he was working for a farmer. And my mom called the farmer and said for my dad to bring home some milk. And my dad went to the dairy bar, and in his work clothes, his coveralls, those blue and kind of gray striped things you wear on the farm. Anyway, Kennedy was campaigning, and he saw my dad, and he jumped off the car, and he reached over to grab my dad's hand. He shook his hand, and he said, "Are you a farmer?" Anyway, so that's the legend in our, you know, that really happened. And then growing up, we had PT 109, Profiles in Courage, in the shelf that my mom bought. So,
Christine, thanks a lot for sharing that. BJ, as you go around the state now talking about this book, is this a part of a lot of family stories, the time they met or their ancestor met Kennedy in Wisconsin?
Well, we did the first reading yesterday in Milwaukee, and it was incredible. Pat Lucy's son came out. There was a woman in the front row who actually was on location for one of the scenes I read about. Someone brought her autograph book and shared an autograph. Several people had individual photos with Kennedy. It was more than I could have dreamed. Everyone's got a story, and I think that really speaks to Kennedy's hard campaigning work.
Thanks a lot for that call. And BJ, thanks for joining us. Good luck with your campaign on your book tour.
Thank you so much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's BJ Hollers, professor of English at UW Eau Claire, the author of several books. We've been talking about his latest. It's called Wisconsin for Kennedy, the primary that launched a president and changed the course of history. It tells the story of John F. Kennedy's 1960 campaign here in Wisconsin and the Wisconsinites who helped secure that primary victory. Hey, if you've got one of those stories in your community or family history, send it along. We could forward it to BJ for you as well. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, immigration and related issues are showing up as concerns for voters in the 2024 election season. We'll find out how it could impact the race here in Wisconsin. And war novels have tried to capture the front lines for centuries, while other books have been used to inspire and rally troops. We'll look into the printed word during wartime and how it's been used for good and ill with the author of the book, The Book at War. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.